Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Foolilove, the Executive Director of the Institute. Just about 68 years ago, on the 10th of December 1948, Australia, along with 47 other countries, adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in Paris. And today we welcome Foreign Minister Julie Bishop to talk about Australia's engagement with human rights. It's good to see such a packed room and so much interest in this speech, so welcome everybody. Ladies and gentlemen, here in Australia we have, it sometimes seems to me, an odd debate on the United Nations. On the one hand, you have UN, what I call UN groupies, who defend the organisation come what may. National interests to these people are always seen as suspect. The blame for any mistakes is always laid at the feet of the member states and not the organisation. The problems pointed out by critics of the UN are waved away, in my opinion, to the detriment of the organisation the UN groupies think they are protecting. In the opposing trenches are a different tribe, the UN bashers. They argue either that the international organisation is incompetent or that it's omnipotent. Sometimes they argue both. They complain about the regimes represented in New York, forgetting that an international body should, for the sake of its effectiveness, include states that cause problems as well as states that fix them. And we're having a bit of a similar debate now on the UN Human Rights Council. On the UN groupie side, you sometimes hear critics say it's hypocritical for Australia to run for the Human Rights Council because we have our own frailties and imperfections. On the UN bashers side, you sometimes hear people say that any human rights body on which countries like Saudi Arabia and Cuba sit isn't worth sitting on. I would turn the question around and I would ask this, what other countries, aside from Australia, would you like to see sit on the Human Rights Council? Of course, we are not a perfect human rights avatar, no country is, but we have a strong human rights record, and my own view is the Human Rights Council will be a better body if Australia is represented on it. Ladies and gentlemen, today we're delighted to be joined by a good friend of the Institute, the Honourable Julie Bishop, MP, Minister for Foreign Affairs, to discuss some of these issues. Julie has served as our Minister for Foreign Affairs since September 2013, following 4.5 years as the Shadow Minister. She has also been the Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party since 2007 and previously held ministerial roles in John Howard's government between 2003 and 2007. She served as the Member for Curtin in the House of Representatives since 1998. Prior to entering Parliament, Julie was a lawyer and managing partner at Clayton Utz. Foreign Minister, we always enjoy having you here. You're very good to us. You come and speak to us often about the issues that matter to the Institute and our stakeholders. So thank you for coming to speak to us today about the role of human rights in world politics, but also to hear you make the argument for Australia's candidacy for the Human Rights Council from 2018. Ladies and gentlemen, the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop.
Thank you, Michael, for the introduction, and it is a delight to again be at the Lowy Institute. Almost 50 years to the day, Australia was approaching a legal watershed. Ever since Captain Arthur Phillip had established the colony of New South Wales 179 years earlier, a short distance from where we meet today, the death penalty had been a feature of the Australian legal system. On 27 February 1788, a mere 32 days after the colony was founded, one Thomas Barrett was hanged at Sydney Cove for stealing from government stores, the first man executed in this country under British law. Legal jurisdictions around Australia continued to sentence and put people to death for committing a range of serious and not so serious crimes, from murder and piracy to stealing clothing or a comb. Ronald Ryan in Victoria would be the last. In December 1966, Ryan and his legal team were down to their final gambits. For his conviction for murdering a prison warder 2 years earlier, he was to be hanged on 9 January, a fortnight after Christmas. The Victorian Premier, Sir Henry Bolte, held the power of commutation as a petition to the UK Privy Council was under consideration. There was also a motion to delay in the Supreme Court of Victoria with blow-by-blow accounts in the national newspapers. editorials furiously making their case. There would be a stay, then a refusal of leave to appeal by the Privy Council, a second stay after a former prisoner claimed at the 11th hour that another man had in fact pulled the trigger. Manoeuvre after manoeuvre, plea after plea for Ryan to be spared, as had been every other Victorian death row prisoner since 1951. In the end, Ryan lost his battle. He was hanged on the 3rd of February 1967, the last person ever to be executed by the state in Australia. The death penalty abolitionists, though, eventually won the battle to end this practice. It's been half a century since any Australian government has carried out an execution. The death penalty has been removed from our nation's statute books. In the decades since, Australia has been a global leader in opposing the death penalty. In forum after forum, whether in bilateral meetings or in multilateral settings like the United Nations, Australia has argued the case for abolition with calm, with patience, and with determination. As Foreign Minister, I've been urging countries around the world that retain the death penalty to find other, more just and indeed more effective ways of punishing serious crimes. There is a long way to go. Our most recent effort to convince the Indonesian government not to put to death two Australian citizens, Andrew Chan and Mayuran Sukumaran, was not successful, despite sustained private advocacy. And then a high-profile public campaign in the final months of their 10 years in detention. We oppose the death penalty, not only in Australia, but elsewhere, for the citizens of any country. It has not and will not prevent the incidence of the commission of serious crimes. And the death penalty violates one of the most important rights enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the right to life. At home and abroad, Australia believes all people have an inalienable human right and rights which demand that respect and dignity should be enjoyed by each and every person. 2 days ago, on the 10th of December, we commemorated Human Rights Day. It was on that day, 68 years ago, that the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We should justly be proud that Australia was a founding member of the United Nations and instrumental in drafting the Declaration. For we believe in fundamental freedoms. Particularly, we defend a person's right to free speech and right to hold personal beliefs, provided they don't impinge on the rights and freedoms of others. Our values are at the heart of our decision to run for a seat on the UN Human Rights Council for the 2018-2020 term. According to Freedom House, 2015 saw an overall drop in freedom around the world for the ninth consecutive year. In a wide range of countries, governments have clamped down on freedom of expression, arresting and imprisoning journalists, academics, and political opponents. Freedom of expression is enjoyed and valued in Australia. It is a fundamental part of our vibrant democracy. Should Australia become a member of the Human Rights Council, we would place a heavy emphasis on protecting freedom of expression. Our platform for election is to commit to upholding fundamental freedoms and rights, many of which are now coming under increasing attack from different quarters. Australia has a strong track record in promoting fundamental freedoms, making us an ideal candidate for the Human Rights Council. Australia was one of the first countries to establish a bilateral human rights dialogue with China and the only at ministerial level, through which we have had constructive exchanges. We were the first Western country to advocate for rescinding the human rights resolution condemning Myanmar, an important step as that country began its transformation. So we take a practical approach. And we've been providing practical support on human rights challenges in Myanmar as it undertakes its momentous political change. Australia is engaging directly with the Myanmar government in relation to our concerns about the security situation in northern Rakhine State, the obstacles to humanitarian access and the reports of alleged human rights abuses. As well as providing generous levels of humanitarian support, Australia is working with the Myanmar government to build a long-term solution to the complex situation, including through funding for education, income diversification, and skills development. We demonstrated our practical, pragmatic approach during our term on the UN Security Council between 2013-2014, delivering concrete results and pushing policy into new areas, including by securing the first ever UN Security Council resolutions on small arms trading and the important role played by police in peacekeeping and peace building. We also led a UN Security Council session on human rights violations in the surely ironically named Democratic People's Republic of Korea, an historic step which saw the UNSC recognise the mass human rights violations in North Korea. Thanks to the work of Michael Kirby and others, this is now a standing item on the Security Council agenda. Without question, North Korea is the most destabilising regime in our region in terms of security. With its repeated flouting of UN sanctions by conducting ever-frequent missile tests, it is a threat to global peace. While building its nuclear weapons capability, it engages in widespread systemic human rights abuses against its own people, which adds to the risk and instability it poses. On some accounts, North Korea spends around a quarter of its GDP on its military, compared with the South's 2.8%, giving you some idea of its priorities. The long-suffering North Koreans have greatly reduced life expectancy and quality of life without adequate access to food and basic necessities. In the 21st century, we must strive to ensure that everyone have the same basic rights in terms of how they're treated, equality before the law, equality of access to basic education and healthcare, equality of opportunity and the like. That is why, in the Human Rights Council, we would continue to advocate for greater rights for women and girls across the world and to assist Indigenous peoples, both in Australia and overseas, to overcome social and economic disadvantage. Australia's human rights principles are clear. We oppose racism and discrimination on the basis of gender, sexual identity, ethnicity, religion, or disability. Australia's commitment to human rights goes to the core of who we are and our respect for human dignity in all aspects of life. It is about basic morality, justice and integrity. Respecting fundamental human rights and freedoms and building them into the fabric of a society makes us safer and more secure. Human rights, security, peace and prosperity go hand in hand. Time after time, serious and escalating human rights abuses are the vital early warnings that a country is unstable and heading towards either large-scale internal turmoil or conflict with an immediate neighbour or within the region. In these instances, the Human Rights Council has a key role to play. It is uniquely qualified to detect emerging crises and to give the global community early warning. Unfortunately, democracy and human rights have suffered serious setbacks in many parts of the world in recent years, adding to a growing sense of geopolitical flux and instability. The world has seen violent human rights abuses on a mass scale for many years. However, arguably the worst in recent years has been in Syria and Iraq. Despite recent gains by the Iraqi government and the international coalition, the terrorist group Daesh or ISIL remains an appalling force for instability and human rights abuses in both Syria and Iraq. Throughout 2016, Daesh has continued to use violence, rape, murder, torture to devastate the lives of the civilian population in Syria and Iraq, at the same time as they direct or inspire terrorists in cities all around the world to target innocent citizens. A diabolical dilemma presents. The more successful the efforts to defeat ISIL, the more likely that its foreign fighters will seek to return home, some to our region and to Australia, battle-hardened, experienced terrorists who may still harbour extremist ideals. Simultaneously, the Assad regime in Syria has used indiscriminate barrel bombs and chemical weapons against the civilian areas of its own cities, killing and maiming children and other innocent civilians. It has detained and systematically tortured dissenters and perceived enemies of the regime in horrific prison conditions. Australia has committed over $500 million in humanitarian assistance to help those affected by the conflicts in Syria and Iraq since 2011. I've also worked with human rights lawyer Amal Clooney to draw attention to the plight of the Yazidis, who have been the subject of particularly horrific gross human rights abuses. In Afghanistan, the presence of Daesh and insurgent targeting of civilians is an increasing concern, while violence against women and girls remains widespread. Australia must continue our efforts to counter terrorism through the international coalition and increasingly close regional cooperation. In our region, there have been a range of other worrying developments and persistent trends undermining support and respect for human rights. The death penalty continues to be applied in many countries in our region and on the larger scale in China. Internet freedom is under pressure and there are increasing restrictions on the operations of non-government organisations. In Southeast Asia, gains have been made in realising economic and social rights over the past decades. However, enormous work lies ahead in promoting and protecting political and civil rights. It is important to work with other countries, taking a collaborative approach where we can, respecting another country's perspective, yet never resiling from our commitment to fundamental human rights. As well as China, we hold formal high-level dialogues with Vietnam and Laos to raise our human rights concerns, systematically and directly. Australia continues to appeal to our counterparts in the Philippines to ensure the cessation of all extrajudicial killings and have offered support to the Philippines government to support improvements in health-focused drug policies. Australia also sincerely hopes the Philippines will reconsider moves to reinstate the death penalty, for as two of the few abolitionist countries in our region, we have worked closely together in the past in seeking an end to this practice. On another front, I cannot emphasise enough the critical connection between peace, security and gender equality. One of the best indicators of whether a country is peaceful and stable isn't its level of wealth or ethnic profile or religious identity. I suggest it is how a nation treats women and girls. A woman's right to live free from fear and violence is integral to the genuine protection of human rights. That's why promoting gender equality is a strong theme in both our human rights work around the world and in our proposed platform for election to the Human Rights Council. Earlier this year, I launched a new Gender Equality and Empowerment of Women strategy to step up our efforts to drive change in our region. Importantly, the strategy is backed by a Gender Equality Fund. With a budget of $62.5 million this year, the fund is supporting practical projects across the Indo-Pacific to advance the human rights of women and girls. We've been working closely with our neighbours in the Pacific to combat gender-based violence, and last week with Senator Penny Wong, Senator Claire Moore and Senator Concetti Vivanti-Wells and I, we visited a number of the centres and saw the work that Australia is doing in this regard. Kiribati, Samoa, Solomon Islands and Tonga have shown leadership by introducing legislation to criminalise domestic violence. Now, we're one of few countries in the world to maintain an ambassador for women and girls to promote gender equality, gender empowerment and ending violence against women. I am proud of the work that Natasha Stott-Despoja undertook in that role during her three-year appointment, and I look forward to Dr. Sharman Stone building on Natasha's legacy over the next 3 years. As I've argued many times as Foreign Minister, gender equality isn't just the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do. According to the McKinsey Global Institute, if women were to participate in the economy at a level comparable to men, global GDP would grow by 26% or US $28 trillion by 2025. It is to all our benefits that we strive to ensure that all people can have the opportunity to participate in every aspect of economic and social life and empowering them to reach their full potential in ways that boost productivity and economic growth. In the years ahead, the Sustainable Development Goals aim to create a more equal world, and equality will deliver a prosperity dividend. Equality is also about ensuring that the rights of everyone, including the LGBTI community and vulnerable groups like those with a disability, are respected. That's why Australia joined the Equal Rights Coalition in September to fight discrimination and violence against LGBTI people, who can be some of the most vulnerable and the most subject to violence and discrimination. The rule of law, strong institutions and good governance are also part of our platform for our election to the Human Rights Council. as essential to achieving development and prosperity. It's also important that the private sector recognises that it has a role to play in promoting human rights. When Unilever released its human rights report last year, the first of its kind, CEO Paul Polman said, "Business can only flourish in societies in which human rights are respected, upheld and advanced. People are our greatest asset, and empowering them across our supply chain is not only the right thing to do, but also ensures a sustainable future for the business." Australia has supported the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights since their inception in 2011. I'm pleased to announce our government is establishing a multi-stakeholder advisory group consisting of business and civil society to assist government and business to work together to improve human rights and to implement the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. So what more can Australia do? To achieve change and protect the values we hold dear, Australia must continue to be an active and visible player across the multilateral UN system. We believe very strongly that the UN system needs to be better coordinated in the way it approaches human rights. At present, the UN's work on human rights, conflict prevention, peacekeeping and peace building occurs mostly in silos. Australia is taking practical steps to connect different parts of the UN system to ensure a more holistic approach to human rights. For example, Australia took the lead earlier this year with Angola in achieving the first ever peace-building resolutions cutting across both the Security Council and the General Assembly. During the General Assembly last September, I announced a new Australian pledge of $10 million over 3 years to the UN Peace-Building Fund. This fund helps countries emerging from conflict avoid sliding back into renewed confrontation by creating conditions for long-term stability and growth. In Australia, we're privileged to have a vibrant civil society, a dynamic private sector, a strong judiciary, and national human rights institutions. We've pledged to build and strengthen human rights institutions and civil society across the world should we be elected a member of the Human Rights Council. Ladies and gentlemen, it is inevitable that in giving this speech outlining our case for election to the Human Rights Council, there will be a chorus of criticism over our support for offshore detention centres in Papua New Guinea and Nauru to process applications for those seeking asylum in Australia. I state categorically that our government will not take any steps that would encourage the criminal people smuggling syndicates to get back into the business of people smuggling. There is no humanity in a government that puts in place a legislative framework against advice that can and did have the effect of luring vulnerable people to their deaths. That's what happened under the previous Labor government, and it's an uncomfortable truth for many. But by unpicking the Howard-era border protection laws and reinvigorating the people smuggling trade to Australia, over 1,200 people drowned at sea, many smashed up against the rocks on the Christmas Island shores. Time and again, as 50,000 people aboard 800 often unseaworthy wooden fishing boats paid criminals significant sums of money to make the dangerous sea journey to Australia, thus bypassing our orderly and regular processing for humanitarian and refugee visas, not only were they placing their own lives at risk, but so were the lives of our defence, customs and border protection personnel who had the horrific tasks of rescuing the stricken vessels and fishing dead bodies from the ocean. This was intolerable, and no self-respecting, humane government or indeed any human rights activist should have been an accomplice to such tragedy. Yep, that's what happened. Overwhelmed by its massive policy failure, the Labor government opened 17 detention centres across Australia, established an offshore centre on Manus Island, and reopened a centre in Nauru. Over 8,000 children passed through detention centres, and there were 2,000 children in detention when the Coalition came to government in 2013. The silence from the so-called human rights activists was deafening. It took the courage, political will and humanity of a coalition government, first under Prime Minister Abbott and continued under Prime Minister Turnbull, to dismantle this criminal people smuggling trade, stop the boats from coming, close the 17 detention centres, remove all children from detention, stop the deaths at sea, and seek resettlement options for those found to be owed protection. It has now been over 800 days since there were successful people smuggling ventures and no deaths at sea. Those found not to be owed protection have been encouraged, indeed paid incentives, to return to their homes, as they should. The Refugee Convention was designed to give safe haven to those seeking to flee from persecution, not a self-selecting choice of where asylum seekers wished to live. Of those who sought to come to Australia via the people smuggling trade, yet found to be owed protection, they can be resettled in Papua New Guinea, in Nauru, in Cambodia, and with a proposal underway for resettlement in the United States. All four options should be entirely acceptable to someone fleeing from persecution or the threat of it. In the meantime, our annual offer of 13,750 humanitarian refugee visas will be increased to 18,750, together with our offer of permanent resettlement for 12,000 refugees from the Syria conflict. Australia is committed to respecting human rights as one of the fundamental ingredients of the global norms that encourage peace and prosperity. As an international community, we should think of human rights as being inextricably linked to economic development and therefore to regional stability and prosperity. That is why Australia is committed to upholding and promoting human rights, and will do so with vigour if we are elected to the Human Rights Council. We will share our experiences and insights and offer pragmatic advice with practical solutions. Our voice will be heard. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julie, for a strong and forward-leaning speech. I expect there'll be lots of questions. We welcome those questions, and Julie has kindly offered to take questions for about 25 minutes or half an hour. Can I ask you, as is customary, in order to get through as many questions as possible, if you'd like to ask a question, catch my eye, and when we go to you, wait for the microphone, state your affiliation if you have one, and then please offer a short question rather than a long statement. I'll forego my chairman's prerogative, but I may come back later and ask one. The first hand I saw up is a colleague of mine, Ewan Graham, the director of our international security program. Ewan.
Minister Bishop, you did mention the Philippines in your comments, but just to put that in a bit more perspective, we're used to the Philippines as being a friend and supporter on human rights. That's abruptly changed since the election of President Duterte. For the reasons you mentioned, the increase in extrajudicial killings, which is now on a scale that puts the Philippines perhaps at the forefront of human rights concerns in Southeast Asia. Mr. Duterte, to put it mildly, has not accepted advice willingly from Western leaders on this issue. But it occurs to me there's another issue here, which is the Philippines will be the chair of ASEAN in 2017, which will require at least one attendance by the foreign minister, perhaps more than that. So will you commit to raising publicly the extrajudicial killings, as you've mentioned, when you visit Manila for those multilateral summits? And are there any circumstances, if the trend continues, in which you would reconsider your attendance?
I have raised Australia's concerns about extrajudicial killings in Philippines twice with Foreign Minister Yasse, the last being at UNGA Leaders Week in September. It's the last time I saw him. But we have continued to raise our concerns in the Philippines. As I said, we've offered the Philippines health officials Australia's technical assistance with addressing issues in a balanced way, particularly in relation to drug policy. And we're seeking to tackle both supply and demand in the illicit drugs trade, and promoting the respect for human rights as we seek to do so. We're also offering support to human rights organisations within the Philippines, like the Commission on Human Rights. That's the Philippines, you know, National Human Rights Institution. So we're providing practical support and advice. I know that there will be an opportunity for the Prime Minister to meet again with President Duterte through ASEAN. And yes, I will, all things being equal, attend the ASEAN meeting in the Philippines. I can't speculate on what circumstances might arise. I don't think it'd be helpful to look at hypotheticals at this stage. But my tendency is to meet people directly and raise concerns with them. And just because the nation is hosting ASEAN doesn't mean that I shouldn't attend and raise our issues of concern with the host nation. And this has occurred in the past with ASEAN. There have been concerns about human rights abuses in other ASEAN countries. And when they host ASEAN, I think the practice of most Australian foreign ministers would be to turn up and raise the issue. To boycott it would enable them to not have to be confronted by their critics. So my choice would be to attend and raise these matters. But we'll obviously follow events very closely between now and the Philippines hosting of it. I do have an annual meeting, formal meeting, with the Philippines foreign minister, and it's the Philippines' turn to host it in 2017. And so I'm intending to pursue that course as well.
The next hand I saw was from this lady here, and then I saw this gentleman here in the blue shirt. Madam, if you could use the microphone.
Thank you, Minister. Robin Fitzsimons. You mentioned the importance of business involvement in human rights. Your Western Australian compatriot, so to speak, Mr. Forrest, brought up the issue of supply chain monitoring and following on the UK Act, which I think was a couple of years ago, which requires companies of over a certain turnover to monitor and report on the same. Given the reported fact that over half, I think, of human trafficking is said to occur in the Asia-Pacific region, do you have any comments on Mr. Forrest's proposal for legislation?
Andrew Forrest has been a very strong advocate against slavery and human trafficking for some time, and he has set up a foundation, Walk Free, which advocates very strongly around the world for the end of human trafficking and modern slavery. The United Kingdom did pass the Modern Slavery Act when Theresa May was Home Secretary, I believe, and it was a matter that she had promoted. And now as Prime Minister, she has been a very strong voice in the efforts to end modern slavery. We are currently considering an Australian version of the Modern Slavery Act. Michael Keenan is the relevant minister with responsibility for it, and I know that there is a review underway. Indeed, I attended a stakeholder meeting in the last week of Parliament when we focused on issues of human trafficking, people smuggling, modern slavery, when the review was discussed. Andrew Forrest has, I understand, made contact with a number of business representatives to ascertain the response of the business community, and that will obviously be available to us when this review is undertaken. We are also the co-chair of the Bali process, and I might just segue into that because it involves Andrew Forrest as well. The Bali process is a forum set up where Australia and Indonesia co-host. There are about 45 countries to deal with the issue of the movement of people, and there are source, transit and destination countries represented in the Bali process. Last March in Indonesia, we set up the Bali Process Business Forum, which will involve business in the supply chain issues and what role business can play in the Bali process. And I've asked Andrew Forrest to be our representative on that Bali Process Business Forum. And there'll be an Indonesian counterpart to co-host it, and they'll be holding a meeting next year to, again, put this issue of human trafficking, people smuggling and modern slavery into focus, with an emphasis on the role that private sector can play.
Hello, Jamie Smith from the Financial Times. One human rights issue that you didn't mention in the speech was the idea of climate change and also access to energy throughout Asia. And it's an area that Australia always seems to come up feel quite divided on because of its large coal industry, but also its desire to lead on emissions reduction. Now, in one international institution, there's a debate going on at the minute, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, over its energy guidelines, and the Minerals Council of Australia and the BCA are both lobbying to ensure that coal projects can be supported. I'm wondering, is the government supporting their efforts in this? And also, more generally, should public money be available to support coal projects? Thank you.
It's kind of linked to the campaign for the Human Rights Council.
It's not actually, but anyway, if you want to talk about climate change, a couple of points. Australia has ratified the Paris Agreement. We have put forward our nationally determined contribution, which is a 26 to 28% reduction in our contribution to greenhouse gas emissions on 2005 levels by 2030. We have met and beaten our Kyoto target. We are on track to exceed our 2020 target, and I have no doubt that we will meet and exceed our 2030 target. The same can't be said of many other countries around the world. Secondly, we are focused on supporting vulnerable countries who are suffering from the effects of climate change, particularly in the Pacific. And I mentioned the bipartisan visit that was undertaken last week. Again, the Pacific is one of the most vulnerable regions in the world when it comes to extreme climate events. And Australia is at the forefront of providing support to those countries. In fact, much of our aid program to the Pacific is now focused on climate change resilient projects done in partnership with those countries. Australia is also the co-chair of the Green Climate Fund. We pledged $200 million to it and paid it, unlike many other countries. And we're a co-chair of that to ensure that of this global fund, a considerable amount is directed towards the Pacific because of its vulnerability. It has been estimated by many experts that coal and fossil fuels will be a fundamental element of energy supply for years to come, and that it will be essential for some countries to be able to reach an acceptable level of development to have supplies of cheap, reliable energy. And given the number of people around the world who still do not have access to electricity, this is a fundamental human right. So to ensure that this energy level is obtained, there will continue to be coal mines around the world. Australia is committed to reducing its greenhouse gas emissions. As I said, we're committed to the development of renewable energies, but we also have to be realistic and pragmatic, and there is a place for coal in energy requirements for decades to come.
I saw Elaine Pearson next from Human Rights Watch.
The last thing I should add, though, sorry, is that I think Australia's great contribution in this regard will be to innovate through research and development to come up with cleaner, better, more efficient ways of producing energy from fossil fuels. I think that's where Australia will make its greatest contribution.
Elaine Pearson from Human Rights Watch. Minister, you mounted a very vigorous defence of Australia's offshore detention policies, yet time and again the UN has criticised Australia for flouting international law when it comes to refugees. And just this week, the New York Times had an article which referred to Australia as unparalleled in its exercise of physical and mental cruelty to refugees on Manus and Nauru. I guess my question is this: won't this harm Australia's candidacy for a seat at the Human Rights Council when it's clear that refugees are going to be a key issue for the Human Rights Council to determine? And yet Australia seems to be repeatedly ignoring the recommendations that are made by UN bodies to address the abuses in offshore detention.
I reject outright that Australia has flouted international laws, and I reject outright that we have willfully or in any way abused or breached people's human rights in relation to conditions in regional processing centres. The governments of Papua New Guinea and Nauru are independent sovereign governments, and they have committed to treat asylum seekers and refugees with respect and dignity and in accordance with relevant human rights standards. Now, these regional processing centres in PNG and Nauru are open, meaning people can move in and out of the centres. I have visited the centres in Nauru. Australia is providing significant support to PNG and Nauru to help ensure the health, safety and welfare. Those who are not found to be owed protection have no right to be there and should go home. Those who are found to be owed protection currently have four choices available to them, and we're working to find other resettlement options. And we welcome the independent scrutiny of Australia's support in regional processing arrangements, the United Nations Refugee Agency, International Committee of Red Cross, Commonwealth Ombudsman and others have all had access, Sky News no less. And the Australian government will continue to raise with these oversight bodies and service providers any issues that they bring to our attention. And so I believe that given the hand we were dealt when we came into government, we have done all we can. We've removed every child from detention. We have found options for resettlement. We've closed 17 detention centres. I haven't gone back to check where the New York Times was in 2011-2012 on these issues.
The gentleman there has been trying to get my attention, yes?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, thank you. Derek Henderson. What do you say to the UN bashers that were mentioned in Mr. Fuller Love's introduction when they say Saudi Arabia's there, why should we?
Well, I think Michael Fully Love put it perfectly when he said, if Australia isn't on the Human Rights Council, who would you rather see on it? Now, all member states have the right, as a member of the UN, to put their hand up for the Human Rights Council. Australia's not been on this particular body before. We're receiving a great deal of encouragement that Australia, which is a champion of human rights and the issues that I've raised, the abolition of the death penalty, gender equality for women and girls, areas where we are leading, there's been a lot of support for Australia to be on the Human Rights Council and offer the same kind of practical, realistic, pragmatic advice that we did when we were on the UN Security Council. And so there's no point in complaining about Saudi Arabia or Cuba or Venezuela or whomever else is on the Human Rights Council. If you don't stand yourself and seek to be elected, then you really have little right to complain about others who do.
Minister, can I ask you a follow-up? That sort of leads us to the question of the politics of the United Nations. Mm. You've talked a lot about the argument, the case for Australia's candidacy. What can you tell us about the horse race, the politics of it? My understanding is there are two other candidates for the Western European and others group, Spain and France. What are our chances of knocking them over? And in a related question, can I ask you, we have a new Secretary General, Mr. Guterres. What contact, if any, have you had with Mr. Guterres, and do you think he can make the United Nations great again?
Well, on the tactics of our Human Rights Council campaign, you will be well aware that we have some experience within the Department of Foreign Affairs of Trade of against the odds being able to secure election to a UN body. And we have some very experienced DFAT officers who are working assiduously on this particular campaign because I believe it matters. It does matter that Australia be represented from time to time on the Human Rights Council. And I actually think that my criticism of the UN Security Council bid was that we were running at a time when the odds were so stacked against us we'd have to spend an inordinate amount of time, money, resources to buy our way onto the Security Council, which is essentially what happened. But in relation to the Human Rights Council, we're up against France and Spain because of this quaint definition of Australia as being part of Western Europe and others. And I've been putting it quite bluntly to people saying, look, love France, love Spain, but you really don't need neighbours from the EU, both being on the Human Rights Council. Pick one of them and then us from our part of the world. And that actually seems to go over rather well. I haven't offended France and Spain. I've just said, love them both, but you only need one from the EU and get Australia from our region. And I think our friends in the Pacific and Southeast Asia and elsewhere find that an appealing argument. In relation to Guterres, yes, I know him well. I've met him on a number of occasions in Geneva in his previous roles, and we've had some very open and frank discussions and his assessment of Australia. And I've met him as opposition foreign minister and also in this role. I believe he has a lot of goodwill from the countries that have backed him. Most importantly, he had the backing of the Security Council. I really did think that this was going to get down to a much more detailed negotiation, horse trade between the members of the Security Council, but he seemed to have gained support from the United States and Russia, and I thought if you could balance those two, he must be quite a guy. So I think there's a lot of goodwill attaching to his appointment, but also he does have the capacity to make significant change in the UN as long as the Permanent Five continue to back his judgment and his efforts. And that's where it falls down time and time again, doesn't it? When one or other of the Permanent Five just put a kibosh on it. But he seems to have got a lot of goodwill, and I hope that he can do some positive things with it, because if there were no such body as the United Nations, we sure as hell would need one today. So it would be created if it did not exist.
We're almost out of time. I'm going to sneak in a couple of extra questions, which I might invite
and
Julie.
I'd stay here all day, except I have to catch a plane to Canberra. There's a cabinet meeting and all those sorts of things I have to attend. Otherwise, I'd be here all day,
all right.
Believe me.
So we'll take one final question in that case from this lady who's been trying to get my... Okay, we'll take two questions. So I'll ask this lady, and there was I saw your name for your hand first, madam. We'll take both those questions and let Julie answer both of them at once.
Minister Bishop, thank you for today. My name's Artie. It's really heartwarming to hear a genuine commitment to gender equality and empowering women, particularly within our region. So Australia obviously has a lot it can empower others within the Asia-Pacific to take on board. I think a big part of the learning in Australia is that empowering women is about empowering men as well, and the private sector has taken a really strong lead in that, particularly around paternity leave. How does that feature in your regional strategy for empowering women?
All right, and the other question was from, yes, lady with the microphone.
Hi, it's Emily Howie here from the Human Rights Law Centre. A couple of the pillars of the Australian bid, Minister, seem to also raise issues that could be of areas of vulnerability on Australia's domestic human rights policy. For example, freedom of speech, we have things like the Border Force Act, anti-racism, our proper, I think, opposition to racism could also raise the 18C debate. And then with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people being a pillar, we also have our own human rights issues to address at home. So I wonder if you could comment on how you think how we're falling behind at home could actually affect our bid for a Human Rights Council seat.
I think Michael said in the introduction, perhaps if I answer Emily first and then come back to Artie, I think Michael said in his introduction that no country is perfect, and that is stating the obvious. We all have domestic challenges. We all have significant issues to grapple with. But I think in terms of Australia's approach, we have shown that we are prepared to work hard to strike the right balance. I mean, take 18C, for example. We're trying to strike the right balance between protecting mutual harmony and respect and support for freedom of speech. And that's why this joint parliamentary committee is meeting today to discuss these issues. And we have an open debate about it, a robust debate about it. And Australia has an open, transparent, democratic process. So for all our failings, for all our warts and all, we try to debate these issues and find a compromise, a balance, an outcome that most people can live with. And I can't think of many other countries around the world that would be so much better positioned in terms of human rights than Australia. And I think we should be prepared to have the courage, be prepared to put our challenges on show. I'm very well aware of the critics of our bid for a Human Rights Council seat, and if I caved into the critics, we wouldn't do it. But then that would be counterproductive. Let's get out there and talk about the challenges that we face, whether it be in Indigenous people's rights, whether it be in gender equality, whether it be in the 18C debate, border force debate. Let's have that as part of our bid. Be honest and open enough and self-confident enough as a nation to say, well, this is what we're trying to do. This is the experience we can share with you. So, sure, there'll be a lot of criticism, but I also think that Australia will get support for having the courage to go on the Human Rights Council. And so should all countries be prepared to have their domestic policies open for scrutiny, as ours are. Artie, thank you for raising the point about empowering women. Since becoming Foreign Minister, I've made the issue of gender equality a pillar of our aid program into the Pacific. And it's under three general headings: the empowerment of women through leadership roles, whether in their family, their villages, their communities, business and government, and we're making some progress in that regard. Empowering women through the economic empowerment, giving them access to the labour markets and the formal economy and a lot of support so that women can actually work and earn a living, and also our efforts to eliminate domestic violence. Women in the Pacific suffer some of the highest levels of domestic violence in the world and the lowest levels of representation in Parliament. I have to say I was very heartened by my visit to Samoa. They have recently introduced legislation criminalising domestic violence. They also introduced a 10% representation of women in Parliament. They've got 50 members of Parliament, and at their last election, they mandated that there would be 5 women. They didn't quite get there. They got 4, so they've appointed a woman to make it 5. But the experience of having women actually elected in their own right, the 4 of them, the first 4, was so positive that I was assured by their Prime Minister, who's in his 19th year as Prime Minister, talk about stability, I was assured by him that the experience was so positively received by the public that they expect they won't need that target anymore, that women will be elected in Samoa in their own right. So a considerable amount of our aid budget is directed to gender equality, and I have in fact mandated that when we consider an aid program, it has to be seen through the prism of gender equality. What is this actually doing for women? And just little examples, like we had a road building project in Timor-Leste, and I looked at it, and it was a great project that people gained skills, you know, truck driving and mixing concrete and doing all sorts of things. And I looked at it, and every single participant was male. And I said, well, what about women? Why don't they get a chance to do this? So suddenly our people on the ground in Timor-Leste said, the minister wants us to see if they can get some women in the program. Now 33% of the people in this program are women. So they're gaining the skills and the opportunities. It's a question of just changing attitudes, and often just raising the issue can spark a recognition, an enlightenment that this is the right thing to do.
Julie, thank you very much for coming to the Institute. Thank you for making the case for Australia's candidacy for the Human Rights Council to us. You see the level of interest today and the level of the number of RSVPs we have. We could have squeezed many more into the room. That's partly a level of interest in this topic, but it's also a compliment to you. So thank you very much both for this speech and for the support you've given the Institute this year. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking the Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop.